Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. This year, we've done a number of interviews about nutrition. There's compelling information that as a nation, we suffer with high rates of obesity and chronic illness, much of which is due to our cheap, plentiful, and non-nutritive diets. Some commentators refer to it as SAD, the standard American diet. Many doctors have been turned on to the fact that our formal medical educations were sorely lacking in clear information about healthy eating, something we all do that has major impact on our health, but because of marketing and economics, we often wind up in non-healthy eating habits. My guest today is one such doctor, a workhorse physician who developed a severe illness and has found her way to health through lifestyle modification, including plant-based eating, exercise, and de-stressing practices like yoga. She's written a new book about her journey with helpful how-tos about how to challenge our own status quos. Dr. Monica Agarwal is co-author, along with Dr. Jyothi Rao, of Body on Fire, How Inflammation Triggers Chronic Illness and the Tools We Have to Fight It. Dr. Agarwal is a cardiologist who brings integrative medicine to her practice. She's a faculty member at the University of Florida, where she was recently named Cardiovascular Researcher of the Year by the Florida chapter of the American College of Cardiology. Agarwal developed a condition called rheumatoid arthritis, which struck her like a thunderbolt and dramatically changed her life. In the book, she writes about her journey and her methods for coping with chronic illness, part memoir and part self-help, but she's not preachy, reminding us that changing to healthier habits is a journey with many stops and starts, and that every day is a new beginning. Cardiologist Monica Agarwal, co-author of Body on Fire, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Monica Agarwal, welcome to Medical Monday. I'd like to start by having you just tell us about your journey with rheumatoid arthritis, when it occurred in your life and how it affected you.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. I had three children in rapid succession, and I often tell people that I was constantly either nursing or pregnant for 6 years. And so when I had my third child, I still had a four-year-old who was just getting out of diapers, a two-year-old who didn't want to wear diapers, and I had a newborn. And so I developed about 4.5 months or 5 months after I had baby number three, I started manifesting joint pain. It's not uncommon to get a post-pregnancy inflammatory syndrome. And I, about 5 months later, started manifesting these joint pains. It started out with a finger. It migrated around my body to the point within a two-week period, I actually went from being active and my normal self. I'm a runner, you know, mom of three kids, a cardiologist, and went to being almost immobilized. It was amazing how quickly I escalated and became so flared.
Yeah, so what did you have to do to try to take, you know, control the rheumatoid arthritis? And I guess how long did it take you to get that diagnosis?
So, you know, as any good doctor does, I started treating myself for without the care of another doctor. You know, I started because I was having migratory joint pain. I explained to myself that I had Lyme disease. I lived in a wooded area, so I figured I just picked up a tick and hadn't realized it. So I started treating myself, but I didn't get better. I continued to escalate. You know, I often describe to people the glass feeling in your feet was one of those feelings that I've never felt before. And there's just nothing quite like that feeling where you literally feel like you're stepping on glass all the time. And so I probably took longer than I should have because I was a difficult patient. For instance, I changed my shoes 3 times because I was sure that it was the shoes that were the problem rather than my body. I started imagining letters I was going to write to baby clothes companies because I couldn't snap the clothes. And so I thought that the clothes were the problem and we really shouldn't have snap clothing. We should have ribbon ties so that it's easier for people to tie, especially at night. So, you know, a lot of denial and sort of ignoring symptoms and kind of waiting for this Lyme disease to get treated before I finally asked one of my friends to check some of my labs, and they were markedly abnormal. So at that point, I went and saw a rheumatologist and had the diagnosis, but pretty much knew that I had it when I saw the labs ahead of time. What I think was the hardest part about going to the rheumatologist, besides the fact that, you know, it was a difficult place to be for sure, but when I got there, you know, I was told that my numbers looked very abnormal and overall boded for a poor prognosis in terms of morbidity. So in other words, I was at risk for significant bone and joint destruction, and that I needed to get on medications very quickly.
So how many medications did you wind up taking, and what did that do to you?
So I started on methotrexate, and I've learned now over the years that I was a good responder to methotrexate. Not everybody has that. Most people will, standard, will get started on methotrexate, but not everybody responds as well as I did, and I responded really well, which is a good thing. And so I was put on methotrexate and had a lot of side effects. That was the biggest issue for me, is that my hair was falling out, and I had a metallic taste in my mouth all the time. People always admired that I lost my baby weight so fast, but really it's just, the lack of appetite was a real issue. And so while I had a good response in terms of my joints, I felt really lousy all the time just from the side effects of the drugs. So they tried to change me to different therapies, but I kind of felt like, God, this is working. Let's just stick with this. I was too nervous to switch.
You did make a switch ultimately. I mean, and you had an awakening of sorts where you just realized you didn't necessarily want to rely on medication. And I guess, what was the spark that led to this journey of transformation? And what were the main aspects of your lifestyle that changed?
Maybe I was always meant to come this way, and maybe I would have gotten here eventually. I don't know. I've always been interested in I'm Indian, so I grew up learning about Ayurveda when I was in a cardiology fellow. So that means in training to be a cardiologist. I did an integrative medicine fellowship at the University of Arizona. So I was always really interested in sort of alternative therapies. And so when I got sick, it was a dark time for me. And so when you are pushed to a place where you feel so dark, you're looking for a way to get out. And I, was taking these medications. I felt lousy all the time from side effects. I was always worried that my liver was going to fail because of the methotrexate. I was looking for a way to, the rheumatologist said, that I would never come off of medications. He said, the hardest part about a rheumatologic illness, besides having it, is understanding that you will always have it, that you will never go away, and that you always have to be on medication, and so that you just have to live with that. And I think when you hear those kind of things, your hopefulness, it completely, goes away. I think maybe what I've learned the most about being a patient, a doctor patient, is never take away someone's hope, because your hope is all you can really hold on to. And so I remember feeling hopeless, and it was in that dark place where I started reaching out, looking back to my background and trying to understand, is there another way to get better? And it was only because it was almost like all these things were kind of lining up for me, my history, my past, my background. And then when I was doing this community workshop at the hospital, I remember, on heart disease, and a woman came to my office and she said she wanted to educate my patients on nutrition. And I felt like I had my program was fairly full. And I said, thank you so much, but we don't really have space. And she said, well, look, let me just show you what I do. Why don't I do your profile? And I probably was kind of a jerk and said something like, I've got this. I'm quite healthy. Ironically,
I'm a doctor after all.
Exactly. I'm a doctor after all. I know what I'm doing. I'm a runner. I'm a this. I'm a cardiology, And so the irony of it, of course, is that I was not nearly healthy and not nearly well. And she's the first person who actually pointed it out. She sort of said, look, so I let her do my profile. And she said, I noted you're eating this, you're eating that. Have you thought about what these things do to your body? And it was only that conversation that made me start thinking about how what you do to your body can matter. Look, we all know that. We tell our patients, as a heart doctor, I tell my patients, eat better, or before my change of practice, I used to tell them, well, you got to eat better and exercise. But you, as a patient, actually don't know what to do. And we, as the doctors, are so ill-trained in nutrition and lifestyle that we don't actually know what that means. And so then to go through this process of kind of thinking about how the food impacts your body and that different foods can impact your body in different ways was really sort of one of those sort of light bulb moments. And then it really started making me think about all the things that can impact your body, the way we sleep, how your stress levels impact your body. And it really is this massive, almost unknown area of medicine, and maybe becoming more popular now, and people are starting to think about it, which is good, but that there's all this stuff in our lifestyle that we're doing to ourselves that we don't realize. Like, we know, I think, in concept that we should sleep well. Well, nobody is talking about the fact that, well, actually, when you don't sleep well, what happens is not only do you get a cold or you eat worse, or it's just that your whole inflammatory pathway is different because the stress levels are high, your sympathetic tone is high, which then triggers an imbalance in your stress and rest and digest, your sympathetic and your parasympathetic system, which triggers inflammation. And then it changes your gut flora, but no one's talking about those connections. And so it's those connections between stress and the way we eat, stress in the gut, and stress and inflammation. Those connections are the things I started learning and had to sort of spend time doing. Like, I went to conferences around the country. I started learning about sort of all the impacts of stress and diet on your body, and sort of was blown away that there's all this out there that I had no idea about. So it was a multiple-year process. This wasn't something I just sort of came upon and said, oh, yeah, you know, diet's good for you. You know, I really wanted to understand why. And I think there's this line, you know, as a scientist, I really wanted to be on the right side of the line, and I still feel that way. And I want to make sure that the stuff that I tell patients and that I do on my own body, that I understand how it works, that I understand the science behind it. And I may not have the best data all the time, and because the data is not available, but I can understand a pathway, and I'm able to then educate my patients in that way and say, well, I don't exactly know the connection. We don't know this yet, but this is the part, which is what we think. And so when patients come to me, because, you know, I get referrals a lot from around where people will say, well, you know, you're going to just change my diet and I'm going to come off all these medications. So, wait, hold on. I can't say for sure that that's exactly what's right for you, because so much of the time I have data that these medications work for you and will actually improve your outcomes. And I know that diet will improve your outcome, but how do I know that they're equal? I don't, because it's never been studied, or maybe the combination is better than any of them. And so I just think that it's really important to be on that right side of the line, really being objective, evidence-based, telling patients what we do and not know, do know and don't know, and really understanding mechanisms. So I spent a lot of time doing that. With that learning, I think that I practice now sort of the best medicine I've ever practiced, because I'm able to integrate both aspects, which is the science I've learned from medical school and from the trials, and then the science I've learned from understanding so much about stress and the gut biome.
Okay, there's a lot to unpack there. I want to reintroduce you. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Monica Agarwal, who is a cardiologist, also a clinical associate professor of medicine at the University of Florida, and co-author of the new book, Body on Fire, How Inflammation Triggers Chronic Illness and the Tools We Have to Fight It. Monica, one of the concepts you wrote about in the book is something I had actually never even heard of before, and I would love it if you could elaborate a little bit on it. I'd never really heard of the concept of eustress. So I'm going to just contrast that with the word we're all familiar with, distress, or distress, depending where you put the accent. What are the differences between eustress and distress, and why does it matter?
So I think when people always think of stress, we think of it as, oh, God, I'm stressed, and it means that it's a bad thing. Well, the truth is stress actually has a very important function. And so that eustress or healthy stress is the stress that activates our sympathetic tone, right? So it's important. So let's just talk about what sympathetic tone is. So sympathetic, you have two nervous systems. We have more than two, but the sympathetic nervous system and the parasympathetic nervous system. The sympathetic nervous system is our fight or flight response. It's when something is falling off the counter and you're trying to catch it, you quickly jump towards it and pick it, catch it. Or your kid is falling, it had fallen off the slide, and you run so fast to go get him, pick him up, and you carry him all the way farther than you'd ever carried him and didn't even realize that you were hurting from it because you just did what you had to do. That's the sympathetic nervous system. It's the do what you got to do sensation. So it increases your heart rate. It increases your blood pressure. It makes you move faster. You don't feel pain. You don't have to go to the bathroom in the signs of high stress, of this acute phase of stress. And because if you had to go to the bathroom, that would be completely dysfunctional of carrying your kid across to get him help. So all of those things don't happen in the setting of acute stress or that fight or flight response. Over time, when you're done and baby's got help, then you have a parasympathetic activation, which is that rest or digest sensation or rest or relax. A lot of people have different things, but rest, digest, which is basically everything slows down. Your heart rate comes down, your blood pressure comes down, you assess your wounds, you go to the bathroom, you drink water, the things that you didn't do before because you didn't appreciate those sensations. Well, that stress response that we had in that scenario is very normal, appropriate, and good stress. Because it's good stress because it made you able to do what you had to do to take care of your kid or whatever the scenario. So those episodes are good for us. And then that balance with that parasympathetic, where that rest and digest, where we take a moment and we rest and recover, that's all very healthy and normal response. So those are stress responses we don't want to lose. The problem is that most of us live in this chronic state of high stress. So our sympathetic tone is always very high because we're constantly stressed out or we're constantly staying in this state of worry or anxiety or constantly causing that sympathetic tone to be high. And that's when that stress that could be healthy stress initially becomes unhealthy or de-stress or distress over time. And so that's that difference that we're trying to focus on. I often tell patients, notice that your heart rate's in your 80s. Well, I don't want your heart rate to be in the 80s because that suggests to me, or patients that come in with their heart rates in their hundreds. Well, those are states of very high sympathetic tone, so much so that when they're just sitting and resting or sitting on my examining table, their heart rates are so fast. That to me suggests that they have a lot of sympathetic tone, which again goes back to that sort of chronic stress syndrome.
Right. So stress is one of the main features of the lifestyle modification you recommend in the book, along with nutrition, which we've talked about a little bit, but also, of course, exercise. But what are your favorite methods for de-stressing, as it were, from too much stress?
Yeah, so it's interesting. Lately, in the last couple of months, I've reflected a little bit on social media about how I'm so good about my diet, I'm so good about my energy and exercise and being and sleeping. But lately, I've let work creep in and some other things with my kids sort of increase my stress levels. And all of a sudden, my stress levels and my sympathetic tone have been elevated. And so I've had to reflect on that because it's really important to remember is that I don't believe that any one thing is enough to make you better. You have to use all the resources in your toolkit to kind of heal your body. So my good health and eating and exercise, I will eventually go back to that state of chronic stress because I've allowed some of those other stress things to creep back into my life. So I think what I have come to recently, and this is sort of very sort of appropriate because this is something I've been considering a lot over the last month or two, is the need for self-care and self-love. And this is something I do talk about in the book, but sometimes I think for me, and maybe as for women, and I don't mean to sort of make it gender, just a single gender, but I think that many women tend to not take care of the self. Maybe because we're taking care of all of our children or because we sort of say, we undermine or downplay our own symptoms and really focus on the people around us. And this has been studied and validated. And unfortunately, women for this reason actually go to the hospital less when they're sick and when they're in an urgent situation, they actually go in less, which is a problem with their care or our care. So the things that I have been considering lately in terms of ways to de-stress, it used to be for me, it's always been about running and exercise, but lately I've been considering and doing more of, which I haven't done as good of a job of admittedly, is doing more stuff that requires that parasympathetic tone a little bit, really focusing in on it. For instance, I think what we've forgotten how to do in America, maybe more than other countries, that we've forgotten how to sit. And so one of the things I've been focusing on in my own life is sitting. And you just said, like, we got to be active, we got to be healthy. Yeah, absolutely. But we also have to learn to sit. And I think that's something we've forgotten how to do. We're eating while we're standing, we're on the phone or checking our email while we're eating or sitting. Everything we do has some other function. And in efforts to be efficient, we have lost the beauty of inefficiency. And so one of the things I've been doing a lot lately is trying to sit.
calming and doing a lot of deep breathing. And it's one of the things I encourage my patients to do is to pick up a meditation app, something that sort of forces them to and forces you to focus on your breath, focus on being calm. And so I've been doing a lot of those things a lot lately to work on my own self-care, which is just learning to slow down and sit down and kind of, even though we think we're enjoying the moment, as we're driving in the car, looking at the sunset, oh, that's beautiful. But how nice would it be if we're actually sitting and just looking at that sun and reflecting on how that sun is setting? So I'm really trying to focus more on that, and I encourage my patients to, and I encourage your listeners to.
I love that. I love that whole sentiment. I want to ask you a little bit specifically about nutrition and focus on the fact that for you and what you're recommending is a plant-based diet. And what do you mean by that? And does that mean no meat forever? And is that okay?
Sure. Nutrition is one of my areas of greatest interest. And I think that over years of studying now and research, and even my own research, I think that the optimal diet is somewhere between 100% plant-based and 100% plant-based with a little bit of meat. And it's living somewhere in the middle. And if somebody tells you that, oh, no, I have the data to tell you that 100% meat ketogenic diet is the best diet for your heart or for your health, that's incorrect. There is no data like that. A ketogenic diet is not an optimal diet. It's not one that we recommend as cardiologists, and it's not one that I would advise. So what is a vegetarian diet, a vegan diet, a plant-based diet? You know, in a lot of these conferences I do for cardiologists, I'm asked to discuss this. And there's a lot of lack of understanding and knowledge of what these terms mean, so I'm glad you brought it up. Vegetarian has multiple different nuances, but for us, we're going to just call a vegetarian sort of the lacto-ovo vegetarian, which is somebody who eats plants primarily, but will have milk and will have eggs. Whereas a vegan will not eat any animal products, and that includes honey, and typically, not always, won't wear animal products either. And however, there's no necessary distinction between eating, say, Oreos, which are vegan, or French fries, which are vegan, which are all considered part of a vegan diet. So that some people call that a junk food vegan if you eat some of those kind of foods, but those all fall under the vegan umbrella. The 100% whole food plant-based diet is a nuance, which really means that focus on people who eat mostly natural whole foods. So we're talking about whole grains, mostly fruits and vegetables, beans and legumes, nuts and seeds, and really doesn't eat any processed foods and refined sugars or minimal, if any. So those are sort of general distinctions between those kind of diets. So I think that eating 100% plant-based with some level, some people will say, well, I can't do that. I think I would like to eat fish. I will say, okay. Some people say, well, I like to eat, I want to eat a steak once a month. Is that okay? I'm like, okay. And so I guess that what I often tell patients is I want you to focus more about eating loads and loads of fruits and vegetables rather than the details of whether you ate a steak once a month or you eat this or that once in a while. Because I don't almost care about the details so much, because if fundamentally you eat mostly fruits and vegetables all of the time, you're going to do so much better than what the standard American diet is right now. And so that's what I'd like people to focus on. And so what does that mean? Well, we want people to eat 5 to 7 servings of fruits and vegetables per day. So a serving is not 3 strawberries. It's a baseball-sized fruit or a cup of uncooked vegetables or a half a cup of cooked vegetables. So we want people to eat 5 to 7 servings per day. And so as you're focusing on those kind of foods, you're by default, you're getting loads of fiber. You're getting all this phytonutrients that come from your greens. With the fiber, you're decreasing your cholesterol, you're changing your gut flora. When you're eating all sorts of fiber, you're having foods that have a low glycemic index, so you stay full longer. You're getting all these nutrients and vitamins that you don't really appreciate you're getting, like vitamin C and A and magnesium. And so all these things are happening when you're eating this sort of mostly fruits and vegetables. So I think if that's the key, if I can get patients to just focus on that in particular, I really have improved their outcomes. And that's been studied too. We know that if you move towards a DASH diet, a Mediterranean diet, or a plant-based diet, or pretty much any diet outside of a standard American diet, we're going to improve your mortality. You're going to live longer. So that's the goal. Mostly fruits and vegetables. 100% fruits and vegetables, great. But if you can get mostly there, I'm pretty happy.
Dr. Agarwal, I want to ask you, in part of your bio, there's something really interesting, which at the Shands Hospital, which I guess is the hospital affiliated with the University of Florida, you got them to institute an entirely plant-based diet. I'm so curious about that. How hard was it to get that implemented, and whom is it for?
So it was hard. But as I tell my, when I tell people who ask me that question, I tend to be a graceful and gentle lioness. And so, I try to do things in a positive way and try to teach as I go about why I think we should move towards a more plant-based nutrition. So, it was a process. It took about a year to get the full movement moved forward into the actual full implementation. So we have a 100% plant-based menu. So nothing on the menu has any animal products on there. And we offer it to any patient in the hospital, and we encourage it strongly in cardiac and vascular patients. So anybody with a blood vessel issue, we strongly encourage it. There are more semantic issues in terms of dietary being a little uncomfortable with it being sort of strongly encouraged in other groups. But we are strongly encouraging it in the cardiac patients and in the vascular patients. And again, it's available to every single person at the University of Florida Hospital, which is the Shands Hospital. So that's really exciting because there are maybe three hospitals in the country that offer a 100% plant-based menu. And so what we did was we collected data on it and we published it. And we have another paper coming out soon where we're going to talk about some of the concerns that hospitals have. For instance, one of the hospital concerns is, oh, no one's going to like the food. Well, we have debunked that theory. It's going to be too expensive. Well, actually, the difference in price is like a 20 to 30% difference between sort of a standard meal that was on the menu and a 100% plant-based meal. So we've tried to debunk some of those concerns that hospitals have. And University of Florida, like most hospitals, was wary of the initiative. But what they have found and what we have found is that they are thrilled because patients are so happy to have it. And it's created such a different environment, and we've become a model for the country. And what's been neat about that is that it gives our dietary group that sort of needed props so that they can continue to move these initiatives forward.
The name of the book is Body on Fire, How Inflammation Triggers Chronic Illness and the Tools We Have to Fight It. And it's by my guest today, Dr. Monica Agarwal, who is on the faculty at the University of Florida and a practicing integrative cardiologist. Dr. Agarwal, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Monica Agarwal is an integrative cardiologist and clinical associate professor of medicine at the University of Florida. Her new book is Body on Fire, How Inflammation Triggers Chronic Illness and the Tools We Have to Fight It. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening. Please stay safe out there and get your vaccines the first chance you get.